ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new project presented by yours truly, Eric Stryker. It's called The Years of Lead, and I'm going to be hosting it with two of my good friends, Frank and George, who you may know from other projects. And this is going to be emphasizing and going into the new National Socialist theory, the new nationalism, the exciting things going on in Europe and beyond. But also, it will cover a lot of different topics that you may not hear on other podcasts with more depth and clarity. How are you guys doing today?
Very good, Derek.
Okay, how about you, George?
I'm pretty good. I'm looking forward to this new project we're going to undertake. I think we're going to touch on some things that don't get enough attention, so it's going to be good.
Would you guys like to explain, first of all, the meaning of years of lead?
Frank, you go first. You can start with that.
Sure. Well, look, the years of lead was a period in Italian history which took place roughly over 14 years from 1968 to 1982. And in Italy, this was actually an ideological warfare on the streets between the left and the right. And, you know, hundreds of people died. It was very violent. And what we're saying about the years of lead with what's happening today is that that's going to happen once again in the ideological sense. People will be battling again. Now, we're not advocating violence, and we don't mean it in a violent way, but what we're saying is there's going to be a battle coming. And that's some of the things we're going to be touching on what to do, how to prepare, and what's going to be happening.
Yeah, I think as to expand on what Frank said, the term years of lead is symbolic for what people are going to be facing now, particularly like as an example in America. You're seeing a shift from the traditional Democrats and Republicans having a disagreement at the dinner table to straight up political violence and struggle. It's not so much that we want to advocate people to do something violent or illegal, but we want people to change their mindset and to be prepared for this type of political struggle instead of simply staying in the past and thinking conservative principles are going to carry us through the next coming years. This is indeed why Years of Lead is so appropriate, and this is why we chose that title.
I think that the new Years of Lead are not really necessarily between the traditional Bolsheviks and fascists, but rather today there is a new contradiction in history, and that is about globalism and nationalism, which is a cliche at this point. But I believe that at the moment our greatest threat is not coming from the left, but rather from the conservatives. For example, we saw the other day the person that loudly condemned Steve King, the congressman from Iowa, who said that Western civilization can only be replenished by its own children, meaning the white Aryan or European race. When he said that, the person that loudly condemned him was Paul Ryan, caving in to Jews in the press, manufacturing an outcry, an outrage, over something that is so intuitively obvious that even little children know it. You know, if you go into a kindergarten lunchroom, the children who are innocent, they don't know anything about race or culture or tension, and they all sit together with their own kind.
Well, it's globalism, like you said, where it's nationalism versus globalists. Well, you don't have to be a certain party only to be a globalist, or are Republican globalists. You know, these cucks are globalists. It's not clear-cut like it was in the original years of lead, where it was Communist Party versus the Fascist Party. It's no longer like that. Now the lines are a lot fuzzier. You know, you have Republicans who are globalists. You know, it's no longer that cut-and-dry thing where you can really see, you know, oh, he's a globalist, he votes for the Democrat, you know, for Clinton, he must be a globalist.
Simple, right.
that simple. We have them, and that's what the nationalists, well, actually, that's what the conservatives in this country need to learn. They say they don't know that yet. They just think, oh, I'm voting Republican, I'm fine, you know, and they don't realize, well, 80% of the Republicans are no good, maybe probably 90%, you know, and I think that's
or maybe probably all of them except for Trump and Steve King.
Yeah, exactly, and we say this many times, you know, if Trump were to disappear, well, things go back to normal, correct?
Yeah.
There is no other Trump. There is no other nationalist. Right.
And one thing I wanted to add, guys, is that a lot of the other, you know, narrative in what they would call, for lack of a better term, the alt-right or nationalist podcasts and articles, a lot of them focus on, when they talk about the future, they talk about this kind of coming race war or clash of civilizations. And I think we could all agree that a big part of this that is overlooked, which I think we want to touch on here, is that combat between, that tension between people of our own kind, as you said, globalism versus nationalism. This is going to be more of the forefront of what decides and what makes or breaks Europe and the United States, rather than a coming clash of civilizations with, you know, Hajis coming in on magic carpets. Because, like we all know, these people are being fed, they're being clothed, they're being brought in, financed, protected, etc., by people who look like us. And, of course, their kosher bosses, don't forget.
Well,
but
yeah.
That's something we need
exactly.
to focus on.
You know, I find it fascinating that some people in Europe, for example, they get really upset at Somalians. Now, don't get me wrong, Somalians are a plague, but here's the thing. The average Somalian has an IQ of 68. That is within the range of what most clinical experts consider to be Down syndrome. 70 mm-hmm. is the upper range of Down syndrome. So actually, there are people with Down syndrome that are a lot smarter than Somalis. So here's the key to understanding the problem. You know, if a bear comes into your town and starts mauling people, you don't get angry at the bear and then go out into the forest and start exterminating all the bears. What you do is you punish the person feeding the bears. You see, in places like Sweden, Maine, Minnesota, in these places where there's large Somali populations marauding in once pristine neighborhoods and safe where children could play outside, you know, these Somalis didn't fly there on a rocket ship. Someone transported them. Now, think of it this way. If you leave picnic baskets out for Yogi Bear, you can't get angry at Yogi Bear. So if Yogi the Somali goes, hey, boo-boo, let's go rape a Swede, you can't get angry at the Somali. He's doing what Somalis do.
Exactly.
That's right. Yeah.
And you know, that's always what we say. It's like the, who do you blame if I were to bring a tiger into my home as a pet, as a parent, and he mauls one of my children? Is it the tiger's fault or is it my fault? It's the parent's fault, that idiot who brought him in without thinking that he's going, not caring that he's going to hurt his own children.
But gentlemen, I'd like to expand on that even further, because while that is a good analogy you both brought up, it's actually even worse than that, because this is someone who's bringing a bear on a leash into your house. And then when you fight the bear, he threatens to throw you in jail for fighting the bear.
Exactly.
And the conservatives, they're telling you that the problem is bears, and that bears are vicious, and that there's a clash of civilization between humans and bears, not even looking at the assholes that are bringing them in on leashes, feeding them, threatening people. Let's say someone gets attacked by one of those quote-unquote bears. What happens in a country like Sweden? There's other people who call your house and threaten you that you better shut up, that you got mauled by a bear, and not tell anybody. So it's even worse than that. It's not as simple as leaving out a picnic basket. In this case, it's even more sinister than that. And I think that's why we need to emphasize that these people on the other side of these, in these times that we call the years of lead, they're your enemy. They're not misguided. They're not, altruistic. They're not, mentally ill, all of them, as some would say, like the conservatives. These people are your enemy, and you have to start seeing them like that, completely.
Now that you touch on that pathological altruism, I think a lot of people in the alt-right have already sort of rebuffed it, because, if 100, maybe 200 years ago, some groids went to Stockholm and raped a girl, the local Swedes would have probably lynched him if such a scenario ever came to be. You can look at these incredibly vicious race riots in middle America. Things like that, where people still had their instincts intact. So this pathological altruism stuff that, it's a lot of it's based on a sort of Nordic theory where, there's some ideologues that try and make it so that everything that goes wrong in a Northern European country is based out of goodwill because they can do no wrong. In reality, the reason the situation is so repressive in places like Sweden and Germany is that they're just as corrupt as countries in Southern Europe, the political class, I mean. But the difference is that they're much more efficient and calculating. See,
and less brazen about it, less
exactly.
Obvious.
Exactly, because a lot of these in Latin countries or Mediterranean countries, like in Southern Europe, the Latin states, in those cultures, they're very, it's true, because the altruism theory suggests that people with more Neolithic ancestry, which is Southern Europe, are more prone to being tribal or more so family-oriented. And there is a grain of truth in that, for sure. And that is why maybe some of the corruption is more family-oriented, in the sense that I want my children to have a lot of nice things, and I want my children to have a great education in Oxford and, stuff like that. But in the Northern European countries, a lot of these corrupt, well, frankly, murderers, like Angela Merkel, like the entire cat lady establishment of Sweden, these are childless, unhappy, overweight. These are women that are older, that have never been married. This is a different kind of corruption, and their underlings, the underlings of these women with self-esteem or mental problems, because, there's some women that tragically can't have children, but most women that pass their window of child-rearing ability without having children, they end up with mental problems, because that's the reason they're on Earth. That's the reason we're here to procreate, mainly.
It's anti-nature. Anti-nature.
Right. So anti-natural lifestyles lead to anti-natural politics. These people like Angela Merkel, they know what they're doing is bad. In fact, Merkel has said as much. And her response?
Angry, nasty women. Like Judd, what was her? What Ashley Judd said, "I am nasty," right? Well, that's what they are. They're angry, and they are just, rotten people. And I think they know they are. There's no other explanation for it. I think they kind of know it, and they feed off of it.
There's no accountability in that. Yeah.
No.
Well, I'd like to say with this pathological altruism theory, it was circulated around, and like you said, Eric, that it's kind of gone by the wayside, fortunately, but it still lingers in a lot of ways, in ways that are more subtle, but they're still there. So, for example, I always had this question in my mind when I hear that, for example, in Sweden or in Scandinavia, that they were altruistic, and we let everyone in, they say, because we're compassionate people. Because we let in these immigrants, it shows that we're a humanitarian superpower, as the government says, these cat ladies, as you described. But here's the other side of that coin, which is that in a logical process, someone who's compassionate is supposed to be compassionate to everyone. But what happens? When one of these Somalis or whatever rapes a Swedish girl, it's not just that the Somali is raping the Swedish girl. It's that you have a whole team of police officers, city council people, women politicians, who are not only looking the other way, covering up what's happening to the girls, lying to the international media, all of these things. So does that sound like a moral person? I mean, in most countries, and I think even in Germany, conspiring or committing a conspiracy to get someone raped, like if I lock someone in a room with a rapist and lock the door and let them get raped, well, that's illegal. But that's exactly what the German government openly admitted to on national television to everybody. So does that sound like moral people to you, or people who are altruistic or sweet? They're not so sweet when they're letting people get raped and they hide it, or threaten people for talking about it, or telling people that they're going to take away their kids if they voice their concerns on Facebook about it. That's a really cruel, cold, and calculating people. And the whole thing about altruism is just a bunch of bullshit, to be honest. That's it. You know, it's that simple.
Yeah, that's not the answer. We know that can't be the answer because it's not logical. It makes no sense. And like George said, I mean, how can you say these people have a high moral when they're allowing their own people to be abused? There's no other word for it. They're being abused, and they're okay with it, and they're doing it themselves. So how can that be a good person? How can that person be good? It can't. It
also shaves away from, it reduces the seriousness of what they're doing, because, you know, there's a big distinction between manslaughter and, you know, first degree premeditated murder. What's going on in Northern Europe is not manslaughter by care bears that just care too much. It's a Jewish plan to murder Europe, to murder the West.
Absolutely.
And it finds itself nudged in the very efficient, because this is true of the racial characteristic of Germanic people, is that their government forms are incredibly efficient. A bureaucrat in Germany takes his job. For example, Germany and Greece have the same exact hate speech laws. And yeah, they abuse them in Greece just like in Germany. But the ruthless efficiency of the German bureaucracy in chasing down thought criminals is truly unmatched, because the Germans are the people of efficiency. Everything they do is centered around efficiency. But, you know, that's not always a good thing. Like all characteristics and traits, it depends on what direction you give them. In this case, you got malcontents bought by Jews that are using the German police and government to silence dissidents in order to racially transplant millions of Arabs and blacks while disenfranchising Germans.
And to be fair to the German people, I'm sorry, George, remember, they are an occupied nation that has been indoctrinated, and a plan was put into effect to, for lack of a better word, demasculinize them and, you know, rip apart anything of nationalism from them. So, you know, they have that going against them also. Besides all the efficiency, I think there's a little bit of outside push there on, pushing forward this kind of agenda.
And there's also idiosyncrasies of Germans and Scandinavians that they also take advantage of these kosher people. One of those is that, like you said before, Eric, the family structure in these countries is different. Like when you consider in Cologne, when there was, like, I believe the number was somewhere around 1,000 girls got raped that night. Now, me as a Greek person, you know, I'm used to people being very close with their family. And I thought to myself, when 1,000 girls get raped, that means that's 1,000 fathers. God knows how many brothers and uncles there are. Why wouldn't one of them lose it and start blaming people and pointing fingers and attacking? Now, you could argue, oh, well, they have a very very oppressive state. Of course they do. But some people in Southern Europe would literally go insane. Fathers would, I'm not saying, of course, out of 1,000, probably 90% wouldn't. But 10% would literally go insane and
not care about
a mayor or attack and not care if they're going to go to prison and not care, you know, because their daughter got raped. That child meant everything to them. And with these people, it's like they don't even feel anything, or at least their fear overrides whatever feelings they have, for their children, you know, at the level that it's at this point, you know.
And
so
I can say as an Italian, and I would hate to think that Italy has gone down or changed that much, that I can guarantee if 1,000 Italian girls were raped in one night, you'd have a riot on your hands.
At least a percentage of those people, yeah, at least.
All you would need is, if you got 10% of the families being upset, like you said, brothers, forget about uncles, because uncles would, maybe you can say, it's not my daughter. But now when you're talking your daughter, you're talking your sister. There's people who, I mean, I know, I don't have a daughter, but if I did, I wouldn't care for myself. You know, I'm going to go crazy. And there's going to be a certain percentage of people that they don't care what the ramifications are going to be. They're going to lash out. And we didn't see that with them.
Yeah, and you don't see it at all.
To play the devil's advocate, however, I would counterposit that if something like that were to happen in certain parts of Italy or Greece, maybe even a lot of parts of Eastern Europe, like the Ukraine, I saw not long ago, some gypsies attacked a Ukrainian woman, and the entire village got out of their houses, went to where the gypsies were, and just started breaking all their stuff and drove them out. The cops were there, and the cops were either watching or doing nothing. They were like looking the other way, carry along. Now, if you were to do that in Germany or in Sweden, if your daughter got raped, they would make sure that the rest of your life was ruined even more by you coming out, because in Germany and in Sweden, the police are sort of like a military attachment that imposes the ideology of the Jewish powers that be. And so in those cases, you know, knowing that the police might be sympathetic to you as human beings is something that is a bit of an advantage in other parts of Europe that the average Swedish father just doesn't have. You know?
Well, right, but I have to stop you there. Would say that if you compare Greece and Italy to the Ukraine, you're not going to see that in Italy. You're not going to see police do that kind of stuff to help the locals in Greece right now. Unfortunately, they're going to go against the people, and they have. They do. They're a little more sympathetic on the average, but not like Ukraine. It's not like, you know, Mr. Kuchenko, the cop, Officer Kuchenko, is going to come and beat up gypsies with you. It doesn't happen in Greece, you know?
You may have it in the small towns and the small villages, you know, Sergeant, like we said, Sergeant Guido Maganelli, you know, who's also probably the cousin of the girl who got saved.
Right.
He's going to probably help, you know? But now,
that's not really the point is...
Yeah, if you're talking out in Milan or in Rome or any places like that, you're not going to probably have that.
The psychology is what the key is. It's not about the law in this case. No. It's about the idiosyncrasies.
Yes.
It's all linked. You know, if you know that your family's going to back you up and you got a big circle, you see, Latin and Slavic cultures are far more social than Germanic cultures. You know, Germanic people, they go to bed at 10 p.m. and that's just when families are eating in Italy and stuff, you know. So what's going on here is that these people are alienated in countries like Germany and Sweden. They're alienated. They don't have a structure, a family or social structure that they know has their back. And so if you live in a society like that where you're alone, what happens when you go and punch a Turk that is harassing you? The Turk's entire family is going to come and kill you.
That's right.
And you're not going to have anyone helping you.
Mm-hmm. And I think you can say that one of the differences is that if you look at our societies versus, let's say, the northern people, the people of the north, as we say in Italy, we are more, like you said, family clannish, where they are, as a society, they're more together. Because from their past, think about it. Think about how their structure was. They worked together for the benefit of everyone. So they all worked as one. And when you talk about the people in Southern Europe, we're a little different. We're, you know, family first, you know.
Too many roosters inside the hen house, in other words.
Yeah, yeah. You know, like our family, we have our family. That's who we trust. That's who we stay together with. That's who we fight to protect one another. We're not, you know, a people where, like the Swedes or the Germans or, you know, where, you know, a law comes down and, you know, the whole town follows it and says, okay, yeah, that's the best for all of us. In an Italian situation or a Greek or Spanish, you would be like the families, you'd be like, oh, who the hell with that? That doesn't work for us, you know. And well, it's that type of mentality. Yeah. Yeah, it's that type of mentality which is going to bring out that emotional lash out at something happening to one of your own, which probably doesn't happen with the Swedes.
And there's historical reasons for that, too. Like, for example, in Italy, before the formation of Italy and in Greece under the Ottoman Empire, you couldn't trust your state. You only had your family to trust. You couldn't That's even right. trust people in other villages because you mm-hmm. don't know who they're working for. Who are they loyal to? Are they loyal to the king of Naples? Are they loyal to, you know, the Venetians? Are they loyal? What if they're a spy? What if they're going to yeah. sell you out? This is how we got like that, yeah. you know?
I mean, I don't think that there's a country probably in the world. When you talk about Game of Thrones, let's talk about Italy. They're the masters of it. Think about what they were. They were all different little city-states who would make deals with different monarchies, you know, to gain power and to have someone backing them up. And then they would switch sides and they would be calculating and devious. And this is how they had to survive because they weren't, you know, there was the Kingdom of Naples and there were the Venetians and Milan. They had city-states. So they needed Spain or France behind them or Austria. And that's how they played this game. So they never had this, you know, we're all together. We're all in this together. And this is the only... Now, if you take the Nordics, think about how they existed. Let's say Sweden in the cold. It was Darwinism, right? It was so, you know, they were up there in the harsh weather. They had to
cooperate. You have to.
Yeah, if they didn't, they all died. Everybody had to work together. So
I would argue, however, that I don't think that this is, for example, the family structure. You know, even if you look at Roman history, basically Rome was peppered with struggles between factions that were family oriented, and the Romans used to adopt people, random people, like grown men would adopt like a 50-year-old man and call him their son, just to have that as an alliance in their family. In Northern Europe, at the same time, according to the works of Tacitus, the Germanic tribal structure was centered around... You see, this is something that you see in the feudal area, in the feudal era, when Roman republicanism was taken down and replaced with a sort of... mixture of Rome with Germanic culture, and you had feudalism. Now, feudalism is based on the divine right of the king. The king gets the veto, not families, the king. He gets to decide what the law is going to be, and you have to follow it, because if the king says so, he gets his divine privileges from God himself. And this was basically how classic Germanic society was oriented, in contrast with Rome. So in Germanic societies, you had this chief who was a divine entity, and all these people would live far apart from each other. But when the chief would put up the flag, they would all come out of their homes, gather together, and take up arms to fight. Now compare this to Roman law, where they had a standing army all the time. It was bound by Republican ideas that were not necessarily, you know, for the time, considered metaphysical like we would think of feudalism. And you saw this dynamic play out. And then, of course, in some cases, like in the Balkans, you know, I always say this, you know, breaking away from family, let's talk about Croatians and Serbians. What exactly differentiates them so radically that Croats in the last Balkan War were on the same side as Albanian invaders, you know, and NATO? The Croats and the Serbs are actually brothers and sisters, and they're basically the same people who speak a slightly different language and have a somewhat different religion. But, you know, the fact that they can't that someone somewhere says they can't share a country, while at the same time they say blacks and whites can share a country, you know, there's obviously an agenda there.
Well, in the case of the Balkans, that was really that split happened more when the religious split happened between the Catholic and the Orthodox world. That is kind of where Croats and Serbs had their ethnogenesis. It was based on religious grounds, not ethnic grounds, because obviously they were both from the same Slavic roots, you know.
Yeah.
But that manifested over time, and then other people took advantage of that, you know, outsiders.
But see, that's the downside. That could be a self-criticism for Latin and Slavic races, you see, because unlike in, say, Germany, the Treaty of Westphalia, where they fought this 100 years war over how many angels can dance on the head of a pin between Protestants and Catholics, and yet they finally realized this is dumb. Why are we fighting over some dumb vendetta? And they created the modern German state where Protestants and Catholics were able to live in harmony. You know, and you compare this to more clannish societies. I don't want to use the word clannish because it's not exactly accurate, but, you know, more societies that hold grudges. And, you know, sometimes it gets to a point where it's ridiculous.
Yeah, of course. And it's also, it's a thing where these ideas that these people have, it changes to the point where it becomes destructive, you know. It becomes counterproductive. You're not achieving anything. You're both losing, like in the Balkans.
Well, the Jew Wesley Clark is blowing up your ministries and Albanians are at your gate, I think it's time to forget the prince that got shot by the Croat in the 17th century.
Yeah, but you see, if this was allowed to happen naturally without the interlopers, it would work itself out, I believe, because Croats and Serbs would get rid of the Albanian problem, and then they would draw borders, and slowly the relations would improve.
Well, of course, because the Allies, exactly, during World War II, Adolf Hitler actually basically reconciled every Balkan problem. He had Hungarians and Romanians, two people that have always fought over borders, fighting on the same side. He reconciled the problems with the Serbs and the Croats. He did a lot of good work with the Bulgarians. He fixed all the problems simply. He said, if Bulgarians live in this territory, that's Bulgarians. If Romanians live in this territory, that's Romanian. Now, then the great powers and the Allies came, and they undid all of this, and now you still have tension in the Balkans, thanks to the British and the French, or should I say their real names, the Jews.
Yeah. Well, the thing is that this is the natural progression of solving these Balkan tensions would have been solved almost 100 years ago now. If the Balkan Wars were allowed to continue, and then they would have got rid of the remainder of the Muslim populations in the Balkans, you would have a lot more peaceful Balkans, because there would be no satellite states for the Turks, and there would be nobody like Albanians for the Americans to exploit and build Hillary Clinton statues for, you know, things like that. So,
yeah, but, I mean, okay.
It is what it is.
Look at who America aligns with around the world. They align with camel jockey ISIS guys in Syria and Albanians in Europe, for God's sakes. If there's one group of people in Europe, I mean, I don't know. It's really, I'm surprised they haven't armed the gypsies there, actually, because that's what's next.
Yeah, I mean, well, they're more of a scattered group, so they can't really keep tabs on them politically, like the Albanians, who are more stationary. Okay?
No, they have a time. The gypsies live in, you know, everywhere. In Eastern Europe, they're in Greece, they're in Italy, there's, you know, I mean, now we've got like over, I think we have about a million of them in Italy.
You can't really organize them or use them for that type of stuff, because they just end up stealing. Like, if you built them a military base, they just start stealing things from the military base and selling it. You know,
they sell the toilets. You know, they figure out. Yeah, they're just. I don't think we have a clear understanding here in America what a gypsy really is.
Oh no, they're here, Frank. The gypsies are.
No,
here.
I know that. I know, but I mean, we think of them as it's Madam, you know, it's Madam so and so who reads your palm down on Main Street, you know, and that's a gypsy family who lives in town. But we have no idea, you know. And we heard, you know, we hear stories. Oh yeah, they were thieves, but yeah, we don't see that. They do palm readings, but you go to Italy and you'll gain a whole new. How can I say it? A whole new feeling about them, you know. What they are. I mean, they are hated. You know, they're a hated group.
A gypsy will stab you over a carton of Marlboros. I mean, they really are. Like, I don't consider myself to be a hateful person. Ha ha ha. But I really fucking hate gypsies. I mean, I've known gypsies, and they really are just, I'm usually a nice guy, but when I see a gypsy, I'm like, you know, this thing is like, because what makes me angry about gypsies isn't just that they smell, or, you know, I'm not immature like that. It's that the problem with gypsies is that they take advantage of people's goodwill. And that is something that, you know, that should be something that entitles you to a period after your race's name, you know?
Yeah. They had a story happened in Milan where a bunch of them went into the hospital, and they went into a section of the hospital that had children with cancer, and they robbed all their tablets, laptops, you know, anything they can get their hands on from these kids. That's, you know, that's kind of the stories that you hear about them, and it makes it a little tough to, you know, feel bad for them or sorry for them or like them.
But here's the thing. You know? Here's the thing. Now think about that, and then think about the type of Europeans that say we have to protect our Roma communities. So think, who's a worse scumbag then? The gypsy? Or the German guy, or the French guy, or the Greek guy, or whoever it is, that is going on national television and saying we have to give subsidies to these people who are robbing tablets from kids with cancer. Think of how sick that kind of person must be. And what the hell is that?
He would want him in his country to do that to one of his people.
But what the hell is a Roma person anyway? What's a Roma people? What is that?
It's a politically correct term for saying gypsy, because it doesn't sound as bad, you know.
Gypsy.
But this is the point, is that it goes back to what we've been saying. Is it the gypsy, or is it these people? Yeah, sure, the gypsy's worthy of hate, it's worthy of our aggression and
it's a stinky brown sore, that's what a gypsy is.
But again, who is protecting these people? Who is helping these people survive in our countries and prosper? I guarantee you there's some...
Prosper, I would say, I would say be an open sore, an open infection in your country. I mean, they don't offer anything. I mean, if you see how they live, especially in Europe, you know, in these camps that they have, like I said, here in America, we really don't have a real understanding of them.
Well, they only know him from like Halloween costumes and stuff like
that. Now they actually have a show on my big gypsy wedding, whatever it is, and fabulous gypsy wedding, whatever. But it's not the same thing. Go see what they're like in Europe, and you'll get a new like I said, you'll have a new feeling on them.
Yeah. Well, I think that no matter what, it's easy if you can explain it to an American, like for example the blacks in this country that are just violent for no reason. They're not exactly like the gypsies, but they could understand on those terms. It becomes like a protected class. For example, they don't want to call blacks, coloreds or blacks. They want to call them African Americans. It's the same thing with gypsies. Nobody calls them gypsies anymore in the EU or in these countries because now they call them Roma. What the hell? How do they even get the name Roma? What is that? Roma doesn't have anything to do with where they came from.
Their clan.
Roma is the name of a city in Italy,
But it's a clan. Now, this is my question to you. How did... We always had gypsies in Italy, okay? But there are now like a million of them in Italy. So, which means that, let's pretend 700,000 of them came now within the last, so many years. How can anyone, why would an Italian, knowing what they're like, knowing what they're about, be okay with letting them come in? You know they're going to come in and do nothing else but crime. Period. You know that about them. It's not, forget about the political correctness. Better.
They don't even have the excuse like they do with these other people coming in that have the guys of refugee or any of this kind of stuff.
Yeah, they came from Romania. That's where they came. These certain gypsies. See, if you look up here's another thing. If you look up the stats in Italy, they will say we have a million Romanians in Italy.
Yeah.
But the problem is, out of the million Romanians, they really mean 980,000 gypsies.
Yeah. They love to say every time a gypsy does something that it was a Bulgarian or a Romanian.
Yeah.
Just like in America, it's a good analogy with blacks in America, because whenever a black commits a crime, he suddenly becomes a teenage boy or a teen or they always use euphemisms.
Children.
But yeah, right.
How about children? I heard children. Four children were mischievous, and one was killed. And then you find out it was three 17 and an 18-year-old, and they mugged a little old white guy, and he shot one of them. So it was children.
That's what Jews do with our language, you see, because you have to every 5 or 10 years you got to keep changing the name for black people or gypsies, because if you don't do that, the names that you give them, they keep getting bad publicity because of the article that you're describing.
Yeah.
you can come up. I mean, now they have a new term for blacks, which is a person of color. They're not. Yeah. I don't even see African American used as often as it used to be, because now when people say African American, they say it with sarcasm and with perfect denotation of what it means, just like when they do it with Roma people. So now they're going to start just calling them, oh, look at those doggone Bulgarians. Oh, God. Mm-hmm. Those Bulgarians.
They already do that. They already do that over there. That's actually a very common thing.
Yeah, if you see a person of color, think about it. He can be anything. A person of color. He's a Mexican. He's somebody from Central America. He could be an Indian. He could be he could be so many things, but it's not a black that you're talking about.
It's even with look what they're doing with the homosexuals. They don't call them homosexuals anymore. They call them what? They call them LGBT. They don't call transvestites trannies. They don't call them transvestites.
You missed a few letters on LGBT.
They added like 10 of them now. I know. I can't keep up with that shit.
I make it simple. I call them trans testicles.
What the hell is that?
Trans testicle? Well, what's a trans? When you explain to me what a transgender is, I'll explain what a trans testicle is. What's a transgender?
It's a mentally ill man that mutilates his penis.
Yeah. So it's, in other words, it's a mentally ill person. That's what we're talking about, right?
But see, the scary thing about all of this isn't simply the mentally ill transgender, I should say, transvestites.
Testicle.
It's the fact that you have normal people, supposedly normal people, particularly women,
who buy it.
Supposed to be normal. And they're telling me that some guy who chops off his balls is normal, and I'm supposed to sit on a date with this broad and pretend like that's normal for her to tell me that, when she should be, you know, getting a smack in the mouth for being insane. You're more insane than he is.
Yes. Seriously, when he first started with the transgender, I said, well, what is this? They said, well, let's say it's a woman who wants to be a man. I go, I get that. But why won't you just say they're gay, you know, or lesbian or whatever? Well, no, they're not. See, they can, it's a man who wants to be a woman, but that doesn't mean that he wants to be with men. Okay, so you're telling me that this man wants to transform himself into a woman, but it's not because he's attracted to men. So now, what are we talking about? We're talking about somebody who's mentally ill. I almost understand the gay guy who says, I feel like a woman, and I want to be with men. Okay. I think you're, you know, whatever, but that's okay. But if you're telling me that you're going to go through this transformation, and you're not even attracted to men, I mean, I got a hard time either believing that, or it proves to me that you're mentally ill.
I saw something on Vice, the publication Vice, where they were interviewing this really fascinating transgender couple. You see, they were transsexual gay men who became lesbians and now want to revert to their original form. You know, and once you go through this process,
come back.
You can't come back from it, and so what happens is that these deviant queers, they commit suicide because, you know, sometimes if you're a schizophrenic and you want to chop off your penis, and there's a whole status quo and establishment of Jews that are very eager to indulge you, what happens? You get the process done. You grow the titties. You get the whatever, you know, maybe you can keep the beard, but one day you look down at your disgusting sore that's supposed to be a vagina, and you're like, what am I doing? What the hell am I doing? And that's why so many of these trannies kill themselves, because, you know, the Jews want to blame us because we don't want children sharing a gym shower with a mentally ill adult man who's a sexual deviant. But the reality of the matter is that they commit suicide because of the bizarre things they do with their body that are irreversible. Once it's gone, it's gone.
Yeah, I actually read the other day, Eric, where they're also adding to that. The reason they commit suicide, again, our fault, is because we're stopping them from adopting children. So by doing that, it you know, it scars them and it hurts them and, you know, it puts them down to where they, you know, oh, we're not normal, we're not like everyone else in society, we can't adopt, and then they kill themselves.
Frank, I was going to say that what you just said, it kind of feeds into the next topic, which we were going to get to, which is like the chasm between the left and right in America, for example. Let's go to that.
Okay.
And we were discussing, remember, what they call now the base stick man?
Stick man.
Well, yeah. Well, the thing is this, that you have these people, okay, like Eric said, you got these Jews in a boardroom, and they come up with this stuff in the center of New York City. But remember, there's a chain of command here. There's a hierarchy. So this goes to some local politicians. It goes to some school board people, which then goes to a bunch of cat ladies and things like that, and university students. And these people essentially become the foot soldiers of these plans. So, yeah, of course, you can blame the instigator of it, which is, of course, the our friends that don't eat shellfish, as some would say. But, you know, the real thing is we're at the street level, you have a stick man. Now, what did we have in the past in this country before the precedent that was set with based stick man?
Let me correct you real quick, George. The precedent wasn't set by him. It was set by the Sacramento Spartans last summer.
That's right. That's true. I should say that.
And
they were far more
effective than Mr. Stickman, not to take credit for them.
No, you're right. No. Well, you know what? Not to take anything away from them. I was just using that because that was the most recent example of it. But you're right. That they were the first to really make a stand with that. I'll definitely give them that. But the point is that when those Sacramento Spartans did it, it was further back in time where they were already like established nationalists.
Mm-hmm.
What you're seeing now.
I want to add one thing to George, which is that the Spartans, we know what they are. And we expect them to be fighters.
Exactly.
This is a man who maybe a year ago would never have done that.
That's the point. Yeah, that's what I meant. Because, in other words, what we're seeing now is that the Trump supporters, people who used to be, let's say, hardcore conservatives, the younger ones at least, fortunately, thank God, are starting to wake up and realize that these leftists, these political opponents, these Hillary supporters, Hillary, and I'm putting that in quotations, these are the people who want to put the trannies in with my kids in school. These are the people. Now, you could blame Shlomo on Madison Avenue, but guess what? The ones who are going to be enforcing it are these guys, and you're going to have to face them on the street. Shlomo's going to run into a corner if you deal with these guys first, like Stickman did, you know?
Yeah.
But you need more people like Stickman. You need people to, and the most important thing is not to go looking for trouble. I want to emphasize that. It's not like people should be going to these rallies and looking to beat somebody up and stuff like that. But you have to have people who are psychologically prepared first, not people who are like, oh, well, those liberals are misguided, and I don't need to, I'm going to have a debate and win a debate with them and this kind of stuff. Because this is poison and the sickness that these conservatives have had in this country. As Eric has called them, like the Washington Generals against the Harlem Globetrotters. They're always meant to lose, you know? Right, Eric?
They lack the problem with the conservatives of the past, and I'm glad, like you said, that a lot of these younger Trump supporters are taking this seriously to challenge the Judeo left for space, you know? Maybe a year or 2 years ago, these conservative types, they would have gone to Berkeley holding a potato salad asking someone to debate them in shorts and sandals. They would go in shorts and sandals, and they're like, man, these leftists, we're going to eat some potato salad, and these leftists, I'm going to blow their minds.
Well, I think, you know, just to piggyback, I think what you're finally having here, and kind of what, you know, we spoke about the years of lead. This is kind of goes into it, which is I think that the Europeans have a better understanding of the struggle than Americans do. Because I think that we here in America, when you go back in time and you look at past elections, let's pretend even 50 years ago, 60 years ago, whatever it was, you had Kennedy against Nixon. Okay, who voted for Kennedy? Who voted for Nixon? You had it in the same family. Maybe your father voted for Nixon, you voted for Kennedy. And it was, you know, oh, well, I want Nixon, I want Kennedy. You know, they'd have their little argument. But then at the end of the day, they both went home. You know, no big deal. The difference between the two wasn't really what it is today. With what you've seen, this election really showed the divide that there is more than any other time. You have really seen the global, you're now talking about, you're hearing the words alt-right. When did you ever hear about that? You know, they're saying alt-right. Well, 10 years ago, they just called people Nazis. You know, now it's alt-right. You know, it's almost like it's a little bit more accepted, more a little bit mainstream, you know, and you're these people are starting to get it that they're going into a situation and they were getting attacked. Women were being spit on. They were getting hit. And I think they're waking up to the fact that, hey, something's going on here. And it's serious. It's not what it was like before where, oh, I'm for Reagan, I'm for Mondale, and everybody went home. I think the left, or the Marxists, or the globalists, whatever you want to call them, you know, they overplayed their hand, and they kind of woke or waking people up. And well, like George said, we don't want people, we don't mean by waking up that you show up and you're there to fight, but wake up that you understand there's a struggle happening. And it's a big, huge struggle.
Exactly, because you got to know the law, all right? First of all, if you're going to a situation like this, brush up on the letter of the law and make sure you have someone filming everything that goes down. So
Film everything, right. Exactly.
You got to film everything because in the judicial system of the United States today, which is being used politically across the nation, you're guilty until you prove you're innocent. So
Exactly. You
got to film everything. Have someone that is dedicated just to that if you're going to organize self-defense. Second of all, you got to make sure you know the law and you bend it to the furthest possible extent without breaking it. That's important, too, because if you hesitate too much, then you're just going to get beaten down because usually because the left is subsidized by Zog, you see, recently the GOP uncovered that the Department of Justice was funneling billions, with a B, into leftist activist groups through a slush fund, okay? They want to investigate and cut it off, but this is a state-subsidized, capitalist-subsidized movement of paid activists that are there just to silence you, you see, because the Trump supporters are getting attacked even though they're regular old conservatives or were, because the Trump ideas, because they're closer, like you were saying, to the alt-right, are more compelling. The reason leftists don't go and protest Paul Ryan is because his ideas, right out of the box, are made to lose. They're what I call made-in-China ideas. They break immediately because the only arguments that leftists can win are arguments that are packaged to lose. And now that people are starting to make real arguments for nationalism, against immigration, against globalism, leftists have no argument. That is why they go to the hands immediately. And you have to be ready to hit them back, because if you don't, they're never going to want to debate you because they can't win. Their ideas can't win.
Yeah, and that's what inspired us to make this podcast, because we want to start telling people about what to prepare yourself for and to move in that thinking. It's not about violence. It's about your mindset. I want people out there listening to, you know, change your mindset on how you view these issues and how you view these political opponents. For example, I'll give you guys a good example. Have you guys, I'm sure both of you have heard of Michael Savage. Michael Savage is the, I guess you could call him a conservative. Is that the proper term for him?
In
the media, in the mainstream media?
He's a talk show, a conservative talk show host.
All right, well, Michael Savage is very popular in the tri-state area with Trump supporters. Okay.
He's considered very radical, by the way.
And he's also considered radical.
Yeah.
Now, you know, the thing with Savage is very interesting, because there's people who tell me, and I've seen it before, that they say, oh, well, you know, I don't know why you're talking about all this stuff with Jews and stuff being behind things, because Michael Savage is a Jew, and he's totally against liberalism. So that means that your theory, George, about all this conspiracy is just a bunch of hogwash. You know, you're just paranoid. And that's what an average, you know, Connecticut conservative would tell me because of Michael Savage. But it gets worse than that, which is that I'm sure you guys know he wrote a book, and the book is called Liberalism is a Mental Disorder. Okay? Now, you got to ask yourself a question. Me being a suspicious, Southern European type I am, I ask myself, why would somebody like him, a Christ killer like him, say something like that? Now, to a conservative, that sounds great. Sounds like, wow, this guy's really got it all figured out. Yeah, they must be, because logically, they must be mentally ill, because what they say, it doesn't make logical sense, Johnny. You know, it's not, he doesn't know all the issues. He's misguided, so he only has to be mentally ill. But no, the reason why Savage is saying that, the exact reason
they,
why
they
Savage
treat him
is saying
like Archie Bunker treats Meathead in All in the Family.
Yeah. The reason why he's saying that is because by getting you, the conservative, to view the leftist as mentally ill, it takes them out of the mindset of that person is my enemy and puts them in the mindset of someone to be pitied, someone to be talked to and blow their mind with talking points, like you said, Eric, before. This is why they're promoting that idea, why someone like Savage is doing that. You know,
Savage will also say that our best friend is Israel. So
of course,
remember that.
Naturally.
Yeah,
naturally.
So, yeah. So there's your two points right there. One, Israel is our friend, and two, pity. Let's pity the liberals. They're mentally ill. So right there,
he doesn't say pity.
He says they're mentally ill. Yeah, not pity.
Pity is the wrong word.
What he does do
is he makes you feel, he makes the conservative masturbate to the idea that he's smarter than a liberal.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, like, oh, you see that, Jimmy? These people just don't know the issues. They're so stupid, liberals. And there's hundreds of YouTube channels with these type of jerk-offs talking about, you know, they get off on, oh, that they prove liberals are stupid. Yeah, no shit. But that's the problem, though. There are some really stupid liberals. But most of them, they know exactly what they're doing. They're motivated by pure, calculated selfishness.
On my own, as let's say a young man, I'm older than both of you guys, but it didn't take me long to figure out that, you know, I grew up, being a Republican, and they're so naive or they're so stupid. Those were the two things that I thought of liberals. You know, they were naive and they were stupid. And then it started seeping in on me that, you know, how can I say they're naive and they're stupid? These are people who have gone to the finest private schools, Ivy League schools, grown up with vast connections, you know, in the world. You know, maybe their father was a senator himself, and, you know, you take the Bushes, for example, you know, I mean, they were connected up the wazoo. And how can you think and look back and say, no, that person's stupid, or that person's, you know, naive? They're neither. And, you know, I wasn't that old to figure that out. You know, it was probably my teens when I said, you know, they're not, neither one. They're calculating. This is done on purpose. And for people to think that a liberal is, yeah, are there stupid liberals? Absolutely, you know. But no, they're not stupid. They know what they're doing.
I would argue, Frank, that the average left-wing person is smarter than the average conservative, and I'll tell you why.
Absolutely, I agree.
You see, when leftists say something like Donald Trump's rise is driven by racial animosity to changing demographics, they're 110% right. People that are wrong are the conservative, the fat Rush Limbaugh doing mental gymnastics. Oh, well, it's about legal and illegal. It's about the law and this and that. It's really that people don't like millions of Mexicans in their country. That's what it is. Leftists are 100% right.
Yeah, because you're coming across that you're not telling the truth. You're lying, and you're not fooling anyone by it, by saying that. Listen, here's the truth. You're right. I don't want this country to be, you know, filled with Mexicans and Africans or whatever you want to shove in my throat. No, I don't want it. You know, when you try to say, oh, that's not the reason. They're illegal. I want them legal. Oh, so you would be fine? You would be fine if 100 million legal immigrants came in? I wouldn't.
Well, another thing leftists say that's 110% right is that they justify their violence against our free speech, their violation of our rights, by saying if we let the fascists talk, the fascists will grow and take power. And that's another 110% true statement, because if there was an actual moderated debate between our side and theirs, we'd win easily, because we stand up for the majority and they stand up for a small platform.
That's the thing.
But they're 110% right for all the wrong reasons, but they're right. You see, leftists are much smarter than these conservatives coming up with all this intellectual alchemy about, oh, how dare you call me a racist? I've adopted two black babies. How could you?
Yeah. If you take the principles of a fascist, and especially now, 2017, and you run down the agenda, let's say Donald Trump and the people who follow him, you will see that we are probably on the same page for 99% of the things. We are anti-abortion, we're anti-immigration, we're for a family, we want to build up good relations with the church, we believe in morality, these are all the same principles. The one thing that they may not agree with us would be that we would say capitalism isn't the way to go. We believe in corporatism.
Yeah, and they wouldn't know practice, what that is. In practice, on the economic thing, in practice, they don't like actual capitalism, because look at the reaction to the new plan by that little weasel Paul Ryan, where he's gonna cut Medicaid to white middle class and working people, and then give it to Mexican illegals. Okay, and that's basically this capitalist system that they think
they don't know enough to know to hate it. That's the problem.
Exactly,
they don't know
and that's
enough.
Because of these conservatives like Savage and Limbaugh, because this whole free market thing. Here's another thing I wanted to point out. This whole argument. Here's another dishonest argument that comes out of conservative bloviators, which is that average white people, middle class, work class people want free liberal capitalism. But that's just a cover. And it's just like leftists say about libertarians. There's a large segment of libertarians that are libertarians basically because they don't want to live around black people and they want an excuse not to do that. And leftists make this claim, and they're 110% right about that.
They just don't have the balls to come out and admit it. That's basically what it comes down to.
Leftists in their criticisms are basically 100% right about everything they say about right-wingers. The people that are dishonest are the conservatives.
And the other part of libertarians, and I knew many of them, what a libertarian is, for the most part, is a hippie who wants to keep his money. So he's actually a hippie, but when it comes to financially, economics, he's very conservative because he doesn't want anyone to have his money. So there's that end of it too. Aside from the ones who don't want to live among other people, you have the ones who, they don't care that they live among other people, but they're not about to give them their money. You know, so that's why you'll see that they're socially liberal, and then economically they're conservative. So that's the thing. But you're correct in what you're saying with the arguments that they're correct.
Yeah, there's reasons why that ideology doesn't jive with nationalism, like libertarianism. For example, I remember one time I talked to this Greek guy. He was a Greek Canadian, and he tells me, I'm more of like a libertarian, but I like a lot of the things, people like you say, about borders and about, immigration and stuff like that. And we were talking about Greece, and he goes, I think that free market is really important. And he says, guys, like Hello? Free market, and I really can't get on board with you guys because of that. Mm-hmm.
And does it even market means? You probably didn't even know what it meant.
Well, no, his argument is that what anybody else does, as long as it doesn't affect my pocket, which is a very American thing. And what I told him is that in a country like Greece and the Balkans, you can't have that type of ideology, because if you have a free market and some other free market asshole wants to sell his property to Turks, or a front for Turks, for example, on one of the islands, well, guess what? Now you have a national threat. So you can't have that in a country. You can have it up in the mountains in an igloo in Canada, maybe, but you can't have it in Greece. It doesn't work. It's the Balkans. As soon as you let free market seep into your country, where any jerk-off can sell to anybody with no control, well, guess what? You have a complete free-for-all of people who would take advantage of such a thing. Well, and that's what these idiots don't get.
There's nothing, you know, another false ideology from these talk show people is that there's nothing conservative about liberal capitalism. Because, you see, if you have actual liberal capitalism and you believe that any restrictions on it is going to upset the market because it's apparently this magical entity that is, mm-hmm. like I always say it, the free market is like a teenage girl. If you tell it not to do something, it runs away and shuts the door in your face. But that's not really how it works. You know, there's if you're going to have borders in a country, that alone is a barrier to the free market, because in capitalism, basically every company eventually hits a ceiling. And when you hit that ceiling in terms of profits and industry and whatnot, you exhaust your internal market. So in other words, all these companies, whether it's these multinationals like Coca-Cola or Apple or Microsoft, they need unmitigated access to foreign markets. I mean, I've made this comparison before. Again, Coca-Cola built a factory in the Gaza Strip knowing full well it's going to get blown up, because they're so desperate for new markets, because they're no matter what they do, they've exhausted their profit margins. So if you put barriers on trade and borders, that alone undermines the free market. It can't function because it's restricted, according to the theory itself.
Mm-hmm. That's right. It's the complete antithesis of nationalism in its core. It can't work together.
Yeah, you can't reconcile them either, because a lot of ex-libertarians are coming into the alt right now, and they claim that I've seen so many names for free market authoritarians, and they come up with all these nicknames for it.
Anarcho-capitalist.
I'm a free market authoritarian in the sense that I'm going to start throwing people out of helicopters. But I'm not going to tell someone not to build, not to bring immigrants into my country or you know, that kind of nonsense. And
exactly.
It's irreconcilable, because nationalism is inherently collective. It's about putting the race as a group against any other interest, including the profit motive. And lastly, why would you want merchants and small business and shopkeepers to control your country anyway? Because when you have a liberal capitalism, there's always going to be, you know, a couple hundred people that are going to be billionaires, and they're basically going to use the economy, because they have the biggest stake in it, to their own personal whims.
Right.
So, I mean, how can you... that's why no nationalist party from the Third Reich, the NSDAP in the Third Reich, to fascist Italy, to even the Kuomintang in Taiwan, has ever tolerated mass accumulations of capital in the hands of these private shadowy figures.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah. Well, I think it goes to another point, which is that people in general, what you see with these anarcho-capitalists and stuff like that, these are people who, they don't have an ideology. They have a certain set of things that they agree or disagree with. Points. Issues. Most Americans, they don't vote based on ideology, or most people in general, I should say, but in America, is a good example. Okay, are you for abortion? Are you against abortion? Are you conservative based on, do you feel about states' rights this, or do you feel about that? But these people don't have a core of ideology, so most of them are motivated by this selfish...
They're individuals.
The individual.
Individual.
Remember,
yeah,
that's the whole thing of libertarianism is the individual, right? And
right.
Nothing stands in front of what's best for me. And that's their ideology. Their ideology is me.
That's why those things are inherently set for destruction. Because
exactly.
In a country that's multicultural, everybody's going to be out for themselves. So it's impossible to have this kind of thing anyway. Even in a homogenous country, it's impossible. But it's
you wouldn't want it because it destroys, ultimately, it destroys the homogenous country, which is what
right.
you're seeing.
Right.
You know, what destroyed Europe? You know, what's destroying Europe? I call it the Americanization of Europe, you know, and that could be a discussion for another time, but...
That's libertarianism is about civic disengagement. The
exactly.
problem is that if you disinvest from your community and the society around you, what are you going to do when you need help? What are you going to do
yes.
when there's 1,000 blacks outside right. your house with machetes?
Yeah.
Well, that's
what are you going to do then?
That's what people in these countries, in these industrialized, wealthy Western countries like the United States, they've been so long without wars, without, I mean, well, when I say war, I mean like a war where they were actually threatened on their own soil. And this is in Western Europe too, that they start to believe that the individual and putting this above everything, that type of thinking, they start to believe that that's not going to come and bite them in the ass. But in the past, in the historical, you know, when you go back in the history of Europe, if you thought like that, you were basically going to die eventually because of that. Because by being an individual, eventually that individuality and stabbing others in the back in your community will make you weaker to those who aren't individuals. You will become swallowed up by nations that do think collectively. That's the problem, you know. The people who, I mean, look what happens in Europe now with the Turks, like Eric said before, the Turks have a family, structure when they fight with the Germans. And they all fight, you know, one German guy, he's got, you know, his cousin he hasn't talked to in 20 years, his brother he hasn't talked to in 2 years, he doesn't talk to his daughter anymore. And meanwhile, some Turk that's going to stab him in the throat has his brother, his sister, his cousins, his aunts, his uncles all living in the same house, and they're ready to kill him. And guess what? Guess who has the advantage? Who's smart now, asshole? Is Hans smart or is the Mongols
smart?
Well,
Germans aren't really all that. I think that's more relevant in the United States than in Germany, because Germany
sure,
is actually
sure,
a really socialist society.
It is in the in the government sense,
yeah.
but not in the family sense. In
right.
other words.
Right.
So that's what I should say. That's the distinction. And in America, it's both. Actually, it's not government-wise. It's not like that. And even in most of America, except for some exceptions, obviously, because it's a very ethnically diverse country, even among the whites. But in most cases, that's the average American, a guy who's not that close to the family, doesn't have those kind of ideals, and he's basically atomized. And that makes you an easy mark for all these other people.
Libertarian. The main problem with libertarianism is that it's mostly formulated by kikes who hate humanity. And so, but they don't hate Jewish humanity, because Ayn Rand, who was the one who found this mentality, this psychology that, you know, everyone around you is blowing your buzz. They're there to feed off of you because you're this great, noble, heroic archetype, John Galt, because you have a vape shop in Queens. You know,
yeah, you're a unique snowflake.
And you know, Eric, let's talk about Ayn Rand. What did we talk about before? An unmarried, without children, nasty, right?
Well,
it's all the things that we talked about.
She was a
yeah.
Jew that had no qualms stealing tax money from America to give to socialist, racialist, collectivist Israel, on the other hand. That is
yeah.
why you can't ever take a Jew at face value, because they always have a duality to them in the sense that they want something completely different. You see, Jews see our countries like Disneyland. You go there, not even Disneyland. Disneyland is too innocent and sterile. They see it like Las Vegas, you know? A
yeah.
lot of guys
yeah.
that go to Las Vegas, a whore in each arm. They're
yeah.
smoking drugs and drinking their ass off, pissing in the street. That's how Jews
and what
see
happens
Western
there,
countries.
What happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. You know, then you
right.
go home. their nice, clean country.
Even Jews that are childless, they see the West like this, but they always know in the back of their minds that, oh, when I get tired of this, I can go retire to Israel where things are normal. But I'm going to keep partying it up in America, in Europe, in Australia, Argentina, wherever. I'm going to party it up because the world is my toilet. It's my latrine because I'm a Jew and I'm chosen. But see, this is why if people that all these upper middle class types that find themselves in Ayn Rand, they don't understand that Ayn Rand was only rootless on the surface. She was incredibly in touch with her Jewishness. But these guys reading her and taking her advice aren't in touch with anything.
It's just like Michael Savage. It's the same principle. Oh, Michael Savage sounds like you, huh? Well, guess again. He's not like you.
Yeah,
he's a Jew.
Exactly. He's leaving off one important thing. You know, he tells you all these things, but he's not calling out the real enemy. When it comes to it, he doesn't go that far. Why? You know, he's Mr. Conservative, but he won't dare say the Jew word, right? He won't talk about Israel. Israel's our friend. It's the best friend we have, and he'll emphasize that.
He was pretty. I remember listening to Savage during the Donald Trump campaign, and he was actually really lukewarm about Trump. I mean, he came around to support him like all the other opportunists and weasels. Yeah. But when he first started
I think at first he was against him, wasn't he?
Yeah, I believe so.
I think he was against him. I didn't listen too often. I thought that at first he was against him, and then I think I remember tuning in one day, hearing him be pro-Trump and being surprised. So I think at first he was against them.
Yeah, and then because none of these Jews wanted Trump because they know what Trump represents. Trump isn't another conservative. He represents the West. He represents white people, whether he knows it or not. Jews know it.
Yeah, that's
we
right.
know it. What leftists know it, but conservatives are keeping their fans oblivious to it.
I think that is an important point for us to, you know, before we take a break, I think we should leave on that note, is that just because somebody sounds like you doesn't mean they are like you. That's something to think about. We'll take a good break, and then we'll come back.
All right. You've lived in Holland for a few years. What do you think of the upcoming election? The Jews are saying that Geert Wilders is losing in the polls. Do you think that's something like the Donald Trump effect where they're faking the polls, or do you think that this could be accurate?
Well, I think, first off, I want to say that goes back to what we were talking about, which is Wilders is the perfect example of somebody who might sound like you, but isn't like you. Now, a lot of guys were on Daily Stormer and stuff and other websites, all right, they say, okay, this guy's not like us. They understand that. He supports Israel. But the main thing with Wilders isn't simply that he's supporting Israel. It's that his goals for Holland are essentially reactionary, and they're actually to help destroy Europe in this kind of way. Whereas what I should say is, these parties are trying to slow down the destruction at the hands of all these Turks and other savages, so that way the real nationalist groups don't take power. Like, they give people a false sense of security, in other words, you know?
And, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and so anyway, about the election, though, I think that there is some truth that the Dutch are not going to vote him into power, but I think that obviously they're exaggerating his polls. In other words, they're exaggerating how low he is. I think he's definitely higher than what they say, but I don't think he's as high to win. Like, he's somewhere in the middle, in other words. So he's not going to win, maybe, but he might get a lot of seats, something like that. But the thing to remember is that even if he does win, what is he really going to do? You know, he's, he's going to make it strict. He's not going to let in any more Muslims. He's going to get tough on maybe the immigration thing. But the reality is that what is that really going to do? You know,
well, to be fair, though, I think the main angle with him isn't so much as, because I agree with you that the Freedom Party is bound to lose because of its reactionary trajectory, in the sense that, you know, the Muslim culture has views on feminism and homosexuality and Jews that are closer to nature than Holland's. And so his reaction to that, rather than noticing that maybe the Dutch should be that way so they too can be strong and fight these people back and push them out of their country, instead his reaction is the reflexive move that conservatives are prone to, which is, I'm going to do the exact opposite of what that guy does. I'm going to put a gerbil in my butt and wear a dress and with an Israeli flag in my hand, because it's going to make Muslims angry. You know, and I think this is the problem with conservatives, in that they don't have a fixed ideology, and that's the problem with the Freedom Party. Unlike Trump, because people say Trump doesn't have an ideology, but he is very aggressive and he does have a plan. His ideology is making America great again. You know, and right. he gives you the details on that, contrary to what the Jews say, he's given no policies. He has giant papers where he tells you details. Geert Wilders, on the other hand, he is more like, okay, you don't like these people in your country, then we're going to regulate their hijabs, and that's it. But I think the main angle to look for here, though, is that he wants to pull Holland out of the European Union. And if you're familiar with the HIV, known as the European Union, that is infecting every country and its bloc, Holland is one of the main sources of this HIV, because every time Serbians crash a gay pride parade, you always have some Dutch guy going, "You can't do that, can't do that." Oh, that's a and they sanction them with economic penalties and social penalties.
I mean, I'm skeptical that he's actually going to pull out. Like he says, he might, but I'm not. I'll be surprised if he does. And there's another thing to remember.
I don't think he's radical enough to actually, when he gets into power. You know, it's kind of like feeding off of what George was saying before. These parties, and you have them in almost every nation. You know, you have Le Pen in France, and you have Pepo Grillo in Italy. You know, they're like controlled opposition, practically, where, they're... What do they stand for? Well, they all have this thing, oh, we're against immigrants. Well, okay, you're going to, let's say you do that, and everyone thinks, oh, see, we put in this extreme right-wing party, and that's what they're called, right-wing parties. The truth is they're not, and they're going in, and what are they going to do? They don't have an ideology behind them. They really don't have a system that they're going in with. So nothing, if they're not going to take care of the core things that are the problems, big deal. You're going to stop some immigration from coming in. But what are you going to do with the ones that are there already? What are you going to do with everything else that's a problem? You're not taking care of the disease. You're taking care of one of the symptoms, which was immigration. But you're not taking care of the main disease. So that's what these parties all lack. And that's why they're going to fail. Even if they win, they're going to fail. And all they really do at the end of the day is hurt us.
That's
because people think, oh, well, we gave the right wings a chance, and look what happened. Nothing happened.
Yeah, and the point is that they're there not so much just to be controlled opposition, but to help the left, in a sense. In other words, they're there to create the leftist's paradigm that these people aren't going to make things better for you either.
Exactly.
The right wing, they don't really work. They don't really make anything better. And what they do is essentially they're slowing things down. They're slowing the destruction of the left down
to speed it up later.
So that people don't react. And then when the leftists get back in power, the pendulum swings even further the other way.
Yes, exactly.
And that's really, now the thing about Holland, from living in Holland, I can tell you that this thing with him, Wilders, is actually inherent in the Dutch culture why they're voting for Wilders. It's not simply Wilders is just some cuck and that they used to have somebody else that was more hardcore. They've had this kind of thing for years now. years, which is that those people in Holland, most of them, the average Dutch person is not like the average American rock the boat like the Muslims are doing. If that wasn't happening, they would be perfectly okay to mix with all these other people. I've lived in New York, and I've lived in Holland in a town, and in 10 minutes I could stand on the street in the center of that town, and I could see more mixed-race couples in the center of that town than I could in the center of Manhattan in 10 minutes, because that's their culture. They don't have that traditional thing, and it's been gone for a long, long time. So at first, the first nationalist candidate, quote-unquote nationalist, that they voted for was Pim Fortuyn, who was a homosexual who used to sleep with Moroccan boys. And the left shot him in the head because people started listening to him, because before, when the left had an issue and there was a Christian Democrat or something who said something against immigrants, they would call him a Nazi. But then they had this guy who slept with Moroccan boys. And it was kind of hard to call him a Nazi. So the left had a very difficult issue. How do you call a guy a Nazi who's blowing 14-year-old Moroccan boys? It's kind of difficult. So what did they do? They shot him in the head. They killed him.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of, you know, the whole thing with Sweden is a bit of a meme, as they say, where people assume that Swedish society is this free-for-all, moral degradation, Gomorrah type of thing. Sodom and Gomorrah. But in reality, I think a lot of the horrific perversions in Europe, they're more common in Holland. I think that Sweden is comparatively far more conservative than the Dutch. Yeah. Well, yeah, and you know why that is? That's because the Dutch have had a Jewish problem for about six centuries. The Jews basically took over Holland when they were booted from Spain, and they set up shop in Amsterdam, and they're so marbled, even if the physical Jew is not there in the numbers they once were, because many of the Jews in Holland migrated to Britain under Cromwell, but even if the physical Jew is not there anymore, there are still networks of Jews that pour money and influence ideas and influence the public opinion, and they're so marbled in Dutch society that it's very difficult. I mean, I don't blame Geert Wilders to a point, because it could be very difficult to root this depravity out from everyday life, because, as you said, you know, the Dutch, what do they have? They have a pedophile political party, okay? A political party that runs for parliamentary seats that is dedicated to legalizing sex with children. That is legal in Holland. So in a society that is, because they say that Germanic countries are individualistic, I disagree completely. The only two Northern European countries that are individualistic in the modern sense are Holland and Britain. And that is because in Holland, it's another nation of shopkeeps, and that comes from influence from the Jews that came there and set up shop in Amsterdam.
Yeah, their attitude is if you can make money with something, that it's morally okay if you can make money with it.
John Calvin was the first Christian to rationalize usury using theology.
That's right.
He did that in Holland.
Put it this way, Wilders is a product of the Dutch society. He's not an anomaly, in other words. He's not something that was outside of the traditional Dutch.
He's not what Trump did here. In other words, he's not Trump for them.
You can't compare the two. He tries to posture himself like that, but the reality is, and I can tell you firsthand, that they don't think like that.
If there was no Donald Trump, there isn't another. That's not the case there in Holland.
Yeah, but see, the thing is, in America, there's a base of people that have these kind of values that they
have.
Yeah,
but I mean, as far as a politician, where to go?
No, of course not. But I'm saying in Holland, it's even less likely.
Likely because there's not even those people there.
Right. In other words, there isn't that voting bloc that thinks like that.
Exactly.
People there, they're voting for Wilders because they want to protect their homosexuals, they want to protect their businesses, they want to protect their their drug operations. They
want like to protect we said, it's pedophile because rings. They want protection against the Muslims. If it wasn't for that, they wouldn't have a problem with anything else that's happening there.
So you see I'm sure you guys seen in the news now that they did something with the Turks. They wouldn't let the Turks in the embassy, and they fought them in the streets, the Turkish protesters. And these Americans, they watch this, and they're like, oh, wow, those Dutch men, they're going Nazi, bro. You know, they're going Nazi, you know. And no, they're not. Because the Dutch have a kind of colonial attitude. If the Turks or if any other person who's not white, doesn't matter, if they don't have the guilt complexes like British do mm-hmm. or like French do. They actually believe, like, for example, they're not that they used to slaughter all these Indians and stuff or kill Indonesians in Asia or things. They're not taught like that. They're actually taught that, well, yeah, we had these colonies, but we helped them, and, you know, that's okay. They even have a version of Santa Claus, even to this day, in the politically correct Holland, where instead of Santa Claus having elves, he has little black people. They call them Zwarte Piet. Okay? And this is in the most tolerant country in the world. In America, that would be like a complete scandal. But over there, it's not. Why? Because they go, well, that is our Dutch tradition. And that's how they view the Turks. You see, they'll marry a Turk. The daughter will marry a Turk. They'll have their kids hang out with them. They'll do all these things. But once those Turks get involved with business, or they start to interrupt their business, or their whatever they want to do, they'll hesitate to smack them around or do whatever they have to do. That's how they are. It's all about business. It's all about the money. And right now, that's what they did. It doesn't mean they're becoming the next Third Reich. You know, that's it. It's not. It's that simple. You know,
yeah,
so.
That's what happens when you take up a Calvinist moral system where the merchant is the be-all, end-all of your country. You know? And cool. I don't know. I don't want to get into these conspiracy theories about John Calvin actually being John Cohen, because I've heard those. But, you know, these early Dutch theologians, that fought against Catholicism, and by the way, I don't consider myself a Catholic, so this is not a personal thing. But, you know, these early theological battles, you know, a lot of these Calvinistic criticisms are quite materialistic and frankly Jewy, and they coincide with the massive Jewish expulsion to Amsterdam and other port cities in Holland that changed that nation's values and structure forever.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even think America has been under the yoke of Jewish, the stewing Jewish sewage, cultural sewage that Holland has been under for centuries. America's controlled by Jews. It starts in the 20th century, maybe late 19th century. But the real Semitic infiltration of the culture in Holland is something that it's going to take brilliance to snap the people out of. And Geert Wilders does not have that brilliance. See, a Trump might be able to do it, not because necessarily his ideas are that much better, but because he has the will. His personality is, he's a world historical figure, as Hegel would say. Geert Wilders
He also has a base here also, which, like you were just saying, doesn't exist in Holland.
To be fair, Trump built his own base because the Republicans haven't won the Rust Belt in like five elections.
Well, he may have built the base, but the people were here with the ideology was here already. The people were here who believed in these things. It was just a matter of unifying them and waking them up a bit. But were here.
But
those morals don't exist there. That's what you were just saying.
Well,
that type of thinking.
There's no
morals there. The Dutch are going to become a minority in the next 30 years. So,
I don't know if they care about that.
They'll care when it happens. But my point is, though, is that you can a strong enough and willful enough figure can shock a society back to normal simply by using the correct strategy.
Yeah, but the everything else around it has to be right. You know, remember also was that in Germany, look at what happened.
you know, the economy was devastated, and that's what helped him come into power. The same thing when you looked at anywhere, how did Mussolini gain power? Italy was devastated. You know, you had to have that happen. I think that's what needs to happen for most people to wake up, because the bottom line...
In Weimar Germany, there was already a lot of people who didn't trust the Jews, even then. You know,
exactly.
It wasn't just Hitler. There was a lot of people like that back then. You know?
Yeah, but
in Holland,
that's
not the case.
I think right now, looking at the stock market and looking how overvalued this... if you look at the value of stocks now, they're more overvalued in a historical sense than they were in 1929. So this when this bubble bursts, and I'm almost positive
Red State Randy's in Holland. Red State Randy.
lot